it's Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome here to the 175th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com, and John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. That's www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. My last and my final piece to West of the Guardian, the 2012th in a Creative Disruption series, is still available after more than 3 months at website www.westoftheguardian.com. It is hopefully the left up there to be led, be read by every living American, and I, of course, hope that they do so. It's the last of the Creative Disruption series in the paper, as after the September 29th issue of the paper, the West of the Guardian joined the ranks of the New York Herald Tribune, the Washington Star, New York Journal American, and the Brooklyn Eagle, and the graveyard of newspapers. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online and daily newspaper at my web home. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the country and the world relating to politics, sports, books, the environment, arts, entertainment, opinion, and technology. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, and it's free. Now, to this week's show, the 175th in the series. With all of the weekend's turmoil about the ban on immigrants from the Middle East, the ACLU, the court action with the partial the lifting of the ban, protests throughout the country and the world, we turn our attention tonight to these issues and hopefully develop both the knowledge base and possibly action plans. My guests tonight include Ron Blaze, a graduate of Ohio University with an English literature and classical background, Linda Lawson Kemp, the Washington-based technologist, Amy McMullen, my pseudo-cousin, a medical professional just home from an airport protest in Phoenix, Glenn Strachan, another technologist who has used his expertise for social good throughout the world and has experience working with refugees, then Eleanor Nguyen, an anthropologist who turned evil and also became a technologist. We may also be joined by other callers throughout the show. I caution any conservative listeners or any in agreement with the ban that all of my guests belong to the liberal Facebook group, and you may not agree with any of the positions of the guests. You are welcome, however, to call in and state your opinion. Okay, now let's go quickly and introduce ourselves so the voices be recognizable and make a short statement on your reaction to the ban and action that you may have taken or plan to take. I will try to control the conversations by calling on the panelists. And we'll go alphabetically to start. Ron?
Yes, thank you. My sentiment toward this issue boils down to free nations have open borders, and I don't understand why we have that little piece of verse on the Statue of Liberty if those are not our sentiments. Everyone here is from somewhere else, and we need to be secure about our democracy. That's the, you know, when we show fear, when we alienate people, when we estrange people, just the children alone of deported parents. You know, President Obama is justly called the deporter-in-chief, unfortunately, although I have unlimited fondness for him. But President Trump has ramped that up even more, and there are a lot of children being left behind. They're in the system. Our foster care system, 26,000 per year per child. You know, just that, not even from a moral standpoint. Just the cost of doing this kind of business, people stranded all over the world until.
Now, Linda, you had posted something about attorneys at Dulles not being allowed to talk to detainees. Is that right? And who are you, anyhow?
Who am I? I'm an old technologist, an old systems analyst. But yeah, I believe that that's right. And I'm not up to the hour with regard to what the current situation is. But yeah, there's some ongoing battle. I see a looming multiple looming constitutional crises coming up. And this could be one area, frankly. We've got dictator in chief at this time. Democracy is real rare, extremely rare in human history, and it's fragile. And the norm in human history is autocratic regimes of one sort or another. And once democracy is lost, it can be really dicey to try to get it back. And installing democracy and or getting it back after it's been lost is usually a really bloody undertaking. And we're in the process of throwing it away right now.
Jamie, you have been involved in the airport protest. Are there any detainees there? And if so, what is their status? Amy, are you with us? Who's calling from 703? I've got
That's
two
Linda.
From seven. I have another one from 703 too. I've got someone. Well, okay. Glenn, tell us about your background with refugees, as well as about yourself.
Well, I'm a technologist, but I also work in public health. One of the jobs I did hold in, as a consultancy was to design the system which Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services would use. The refugee system used to be all paper-based, and when I was called in, I was asked to analyze it and come up with a solution using LIRS as the main recipient of the design work, and understanding through them the entire process. There are 14 organizations that do refugee relocation. Nine of them use this software. And basically, as an analyst, the two other technologists would know, you learn every nook and cranny of how things work. And I certainly became familiar with, the vetting of refugees, knowing that it's often years before they get a placement. I know that, the majority of refugees, in fact, 71% of refugees are women and children. They have to have somebody sponsor them, and it's usually churches in the U.S. that sponsor the refugees which come here. My interest is that I've been saying for months and months, as Trump has been saying what he's saying about refugees and that there's no vetting process. I've written, on Twitter, I've written on Facebook, trying to educate people that there is, definitely a vetting system. So that's where I'm coming from.
Eleanor, like Glenn, you spent some time outside the country. What kind of reaction did you see there at the United States, and do you know how it may have changed in recent years?
Well, I've spent a great deal outside the country.
I'm talking – hold it. I asked Eleanor, Glenn.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize.
That's okay. Eleanor? What happened to Eleanor? She was here a moment ago. Okay, Glenn,
I'm here. I just
okay.
had to turn off mute.
Oh, okay.
So I am getting reactions. I mean, everybody's appalled at this. It's just blatantly obvious that this is an atrocious act. And the thing that, as I think about it, the thing that concerns me a lot as an anthropologist is the total misconception that not only Trump and people in his administration, but his supporters in general have about immigrants, who they are and what they do. So I was just looking at a just with regard to Mexico, which isn't the issue right here, but I was just looking at some figures. Mexico's exports to the United States, by the way, amounted to $297.5 billion. Okay, that's 13% of our imports from Mexico. And it's not all in tequila. It's in some other stuff. And as far as Mexican immigrants, there were how many? There were 11.7 million Mexican immigrants in a variety of occupations. The misconceptions with regard to people from Islamic countries have to do with, you know, who is a terrorist. And I just happened to look up this other thing. Like, most terrorism that happens in the United States here is homegrown. Domestic, you know, white supremacists or jihadis who were born in the United States. Similarly in Europe, jihadis who were born in Europe, who could, by the way, easily come here on a European visa, no problem. Zero, by the way, coming from the seven countries that are now banned. So these misconceptions about who's who is driving the permission for these kinds of actions to be taken out. And I think we need a huge education campaign.
That's
on
right.
Who immigrants are and what they do.
When you asked before, I didn't answer properly. No, don't mute your phones. To what I meant was to turn off speakerphone so we don't get feedback back.
Oh, okay. I had muted my phone. Yeah.
My Senator Chuck Schumer has been very passionate about this shall not stand. What has been the position of your elected officials, Glenn?
My elected officials are out there. Chris Van Hollen made a statement. He was, you know, being totally opposed to the ban. I know that we're getting local coverage now from BWI, which is the airport closest to me, about 10 miles away. They said it's full. You know, everyone that I know of, Jamie Raskin, who is congressman from just inside of the Maryland border, is totally against, you know, this action, and I see the things he's saying as well.
Delano?
Well, I'm just looking at a post from Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon, who was at PDX Airport today at 2 p.m. to oppose the discriminatory Muslim ban. And he's asking people to join in the fight against it. I haven't heard from Ron Wyden.
Yeah, Ron?
The seven account for 40% of United States refugee intake, according to The Atlantic. And this is as of 2 p.m. today. All seven total about 500,000, according to the DHS. As soon as the order was signed, a lot of these people traveling are placed on a standstill globally. Anyone from the list must apply for a visa at a U.S. consulate. And the list is Iraq, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen.
Right.
And neither the most terrorists nor the most immigrants who come into the United States who are Muslim come from those countries.
What about
and Rudolph Giuliani said that
what about
if
your
a Muslim, my Congress people are Republican for almost entirely. Rob Portman and Josh Mandel and Kasich and people like this. And so I know that, you know, I can predict what theirs are going to be, but I haven't read anything yet regarding what they voted.
I understand, and I meant to ask that Tammy, if she had met back from the protest, that John McCain came out very strongly against the ban today. Linda.
Rudolph Giuliani said that it is a Muslim ban. He said that Trump asked for a Muslim ban. And then he said, but it's not religious.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, that is how backward this whole logic about this thing is.
That sentence right there bears repeating, actually, in this post-truth world.
It's just double talk, crazy stuff. And then Rance Priebus said that he contradicted himself on national television. Just so that people traveling, say, from Libya could expect extra questions. They could expect to be interrogated. Not interrogated. That's not the word he used. But they, the CBP would have discretionary authority to question U.S. citizens coming in from the seven countries.
See, Linda,
no less of a conservative than Dick Cheney condemns Trump's plan to ban Muslims from entering the U.S. I mean, how bad does it get?
Right.
Yeah. The interesting thing is, I was going to get to this later, but I'll throw it out now, that of all of the known terrorists, the 9/11 people, and the underwear bomber, the shoe bomber, the Boston Marathon guys, the army guy in Texas, the shooter at the gay bar, none of these terrorists came from any of the countries that are being banned. None of the countries being banned either have any Trump business dealings in those countries. And
Pakistan and Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. And today
none
he was not
on the list.
Right. And he went on the phone with Saudi Arabia and the UAE today. In my area, the mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, has come out very strongly against it, as is the governor, Andy Cuomo. Marty Walsh, the Boston mayor, has really said that if there's anyone that's worried about being taken out to be deported, they can come in my office and no one will get in there. And if there's no room, there are other offices in City Hall. And one of the early speakers was the Secretary of State in California, who said that the whole attempt to coerce the cops by money, they were saying that they would withhold funding from cities or from mm-hmm. states that won't pursue illegals. And the Secretary of State is bringing the lawsuit, and they've hired Eric Holder to draft it. That violates Article 10 of the Constitution, that if anything is a responsibility of the federal government, as is INS enforcement, you cannot coerce the localities to do your work for you. If you want to catch these people, come and catch them. Not a problem. And Rudy Giuliani,
you have kind of a precedent,
right? Rudy Giuliani said that himself. When he was at the mayor of New York, he would not have his police go after anyone unless they were criminals and turn them over to the INS. And he said, when he was questioned, he said, "Aren't they criminals?" He said, "No, they violated a regulation. They didn't commit a crime." We know there's been protests all over the U.S. and in many foreign countries. Do you think, from your experience, that the energy can be sustained, Belinda?
I sure hope so. It could be. I'm really hoping that we're on the edge of or have passed a tipping point where the protest can be maintained. Progressives still need to learn how to, number one, think strategically, and number two, unite as opposed to attacking each other. And that's pretty difficult because progressives had a tendency to be independent thinkers, and if there's a point of contention, rather than working together on common ground, there has historically, in my opinion, been a strong tendency to go off and work independently, and of course, you know, the whole idea of, you know, divide and conquer. Democrats have a history of succumbing to that that dynamic, and we need to learn how to come together. I was really heartened with the women's march, and I'm really hoping that lessons of Occupy have been taken to heart, and that the women march wasn't just like a big flash in the pan, and it's just like, okay, been there, done that, you know, it's done now, we did our part, it should all be fixed. It doesn't happen that way. These kind of movements take a lot of coordination and a lot of persistence. The oligarchs have people whose day job it is to create this stuff. Those of us who are not the oligarchs, this is not our day job. And, you know, we have to do what we do with the little bit of time that we have remaining. You know, we don't check in and spend 40 hours a week doing this stuff. There's a lot of people who are progressives who are spending 40 and 80 hours a week, but, you know, it's almost none of them are in paid positions. So it's all a dedication. And that's, you know, what we have in our favor is numbers. In order to countervail that, what we have on our side are numbers. But for those numbers to work, they need to be united as opposed to separated. And I'm hoping that, you know, the women and the gays and the blacks and the Mexicans and the Middle Easterners and the Jews and the environmentalists and the indigenous and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all come together, you know, in one voice and forget where there's disparities of priorities or even differences of opinion. We need to lock down on those areas that are common concern and hammer it just on a continuing basis, not a day in it, you know, at a time, but on a continuous basis. The religious communities, you know, the progressive religious communities, I'm not hearing, I mean, they're active, but they're not near active enough. You know, we need to hear more from them as well. And, you know, some of them are actually being very active, but they're small in numbers.
Who do I have?
Can be amplified by adding it to larger numbers. Pardon?
Who do I have from the 813, Erica?
It's Mirona Constantinescu. Mirona, I'm in San Diego.
Yes, Eleanor. Eleanor told us that you were going to call in to give us your experiences. Why don't I interrupt the present question and turn it over to you?
Okay, thank you. I'm not entirely sure what's expected of me. What would you like to hear?
Eleanor said you had come from Romania, number one. Did you have any difficulty getting into the United States? And since you've been here, have you noticed a real change in public opinion about immigrants?
Yeah, this is a topic very personal and close to my heart, close to me. My family came here in December of 1988. I was 4 years old. And from Romania, and communism fell December of 1989, so approximately a year after we came here. My father, when we were in Romania, he had tried to escape. I think I was 2 years old, and he was put in jail until I was three. And my parents had been filing for about, I guess, 7 years, even before my sister and I were born, for asylum, to be able to leave communist Romania. And I think from my mom's account, the law to that all women had to have five children was the last straw for her. So Romania was what's called a a pronatalist state. So that means, you know, all births were viewed as, and children were viewed as workers of the state, basically to produce, to help keep the economy running and growing. And Romania at one point was growing at 8% or 10% a year. So that's some of that context. And so they had been applying for many years.
Mirona, I thought you said some very interesting things today about your experience as a person and how being a refugee affected you. And I thought that might relate.
Yeah.
You know, you might be able to relate to the experience of some people, either the people with green cards who were being turned back at customs, or with people who were trying to emigrate here from Syria, and how bewildering that experience is.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine being turned away. Our family went to Italy for 3 weeks, sort of like a training camp, I guess, for being able to come. And I know I'm unclear about the full logistical details about why we were sent to Idaho. So my family was sent to Idaho. And there was, from what I understand, a number of refugee agencies, and they're each given certain resources. And Twin Falls, Idaho, was where my family was sent. And there were a few other Romanian families that were sent there. And so the America that we thought we were coming to is very different than the America that we actually went to. You know, given sort of the conception of the American dream and such. So my experience is, it was very difficult growing up in Idaho, which is very, the family that helped us, it was a Catholic family, and they helped us with furniture, and we spent holidays with them and things like that. But for the most part, Twin Falls, Idaho is 80% Mormon, and so it was quite unwelcoming. And even as a white person, which I am, so in a primarily white area. I guess I don't feel like I ever fully acculturated. And it definitely shaped me as a person. I'm not sure what I would comment now about the sentiment. Twin Falls, Idaho has been in the news, and also has been in the news recently about regarding this issue, as a lot of Syrian refugees have gone there, and they've been, from what I understand, discriminated there. And so from what I'm seeing in terms of that sentiment toward refugees that are currently there, it's very much what was present for me when I was there, growing up there. It just wasn't in the news, and it wasn't an issue.
Okay.
So I don't know if this is hitting kind of what you're wanting to hear about.
No,
but.
So that's interesting. It's interesting about the experience. I know that we have settled, for instance, many Somalians all in the Minneapolis area, and they're able to integrate both with each other and into the business world. Ron, do you think that we'll be able to keep this energy going?
We have a significant Somali immigrant community in Columbus, Ohio as well.
Oh, okay.
And they seem to have done well. I haven't seen firsthand, but I know that there's a significant population. But this will be challenged legally in court. And that seems to be the direction that it's headed in anyway, considering that there's like four different judges that ruled against it Saturday. Alexandria, Virginia, and Los Angeles, and I'm trying to think of where else. The other, I'm trying to think of the other two, but
I believe
that's got to be where it's headed.
it's Dallas to New York. Yeah, that's one thing, and we all know that the ACLU has done a terrific job in bringing that through. But I think, yes, as Linda said, we have to keep this energy going. Do you think we'll be able to keep the energy?
Well, they have been playing the long game, you know, for decades now. They've been playing the long game. And Democrats or liberals in general, let's say, have become complacent because we tend to think that we solve problems and then they stay solved. And these people don't stop chipping away at it. They've been chipping away at the New Deal ever since it was instituted.
Yeah.
And, you know, as of Reagan, that's when the real stripping, the dismantling began. And I think it was pretty much completed with the Patriot Act. But now we're going even beyond that. You know, to the point where we're trying to return America to the Gilded Age, where we have completely hands-off capitalism. We become a plutocracy. These people are more powerful than the government, and that is by definition fascism.
Yeah.
I think that we learned in the Hillary campaign that the problems haven't stayed fixed. Glenn, what do you think about the energy? Can we keep it going or not?
When the Women's March took place last week, that was one of the big concerns someone wrote about. You know, you have, out of the Obama White House, if you could learn one thing, it's to focus your energies. And I've started this page, you know, people opposed to Donald J. Trump, and we have 2,500 people on it. And, you know, I try to come up with ways to keep people energized. I do hope the immigration thing is, and the refugee resettlement does focus people's attention. It appears to have. But long term, I think that Trump, you know, while he has us paying attention to this edict, we're not paying attention to the fact that Bannon was put on the Security Council and two people were demoted. So,
yeah,
what he seems to do effectively. Also, he said he was going to sign an executive order to study illegal immigration voting, but we haven't seen that because I think there was such a fury against him that he decided it wasn't appropriate. So he just throws things and throws them and throws them and throws them out, and we get confused what we need to pay attention to. And that's what I've been saying on the page, that we need to pay attention. A lot of people say the money, you know, follow the money. But for me, with this, not selecting Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Egypt is just so demonstrative of the fact that he has business in those countries.
The list of seven was taken from President Obama's list.
Yes,
they could reference right back to it.
Right,
and it was an INS law, or rather INA law, and visa waiver program is what it's called. And President Obama instituted it in 2011, and they took it right. That list is President Obama's list. But I agree. Why that list?
Yeah.
Speaking of Trump, in New York, the protests have been divided in New York City. At JFK, to speak for the detainees, while there's been big anti-Trump protests going on, that is New York home. And he's already pulled back on banning those with valid green cards. But the protests around the world and foreign leaders, is there really any way that he can extricate himself from the mess that he's been in?
The green card thing, the green card issue was resolved in court. That's what was. He didn't back off of it. It was resolved in court that he couldn't do it, and he's saying that he's thinking he's going to challenge that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
On that note, if I could chime in on the energy going forward, if this is the appropriate moment.
Sure.
I really think that his actions with regard to Mexico and with regard to this immigration green card ban Muslim ban is they both have huge economic effects. So we have, as I said before, like $260 billion worth of imports from Mexico every year. There's a business party on this side. We have all these, a lot of these immigrants from all over the world work in industries where they're valued employees. There's just a thing where Microsoft, I just was looking at it, Microsoft, Apple, all these high-tech companies are condemning the ban. Why? Because it's going to have a huge economic impact. So in addition to the energy put forward by citizens and citizens groups, we're going to have a big pushback from industry and, by the way, and from deep state itself. They don't, the powers that be don't really like this level of instability that's being provoked by Trump. And then similarly, State Department, you know, a lot of people who work in government, they're going to be abandoning their jobs. So I think the pushback is going to be massive from a lot of different directions. This isn't the America that we are used to.
Well, well, we don't even have the people in the State Department now who've been fired who would be trying to smooth things all over the world. And
can I jump in here, because this is one of the areas that has me just extremely concerned, because the State Department is, what they do is fairly unique. I mean, you don't go out into the private industry and find State Department experts to hire and put into executive positions. The State Department is a different, you know, just a different animal, and it takes years for these people to develop their knowledge base and to develop their relationships internationally. And, developing trusted relationships, you know, you don't do that in a half an hour. You know, this takes years. And, you know, the knowledge alone that is poured out of the State Department. International incidents happen all the time. We now have a dysfunctional State Department. I called my congressman the other day, and the woman who answered on the phone, and I was in total just frustration. And I said, excuse my language, but there's only one word to use, and that's the F word. When an international incident happens, which is going to happen, it's a given. These international incidents happen all the time. We have a dysfunctional State Department, and you can't be made functional in a month. We're screwed.
And we also have routines coming out from the Trump White House or from Trump himself, for instance, that he might make Mexico pay for the wall by this 20% import tax. What he was really saying is the American taxpayer to pay for it twice, to pay the first time around, and then they'd pay then higher prices. There should have been someone who said that won't work because of these are the economics behind it, but they float these crazy ideas.
It's not crazy, and it's not new tequila that we're getting. It's not just tequila that we're getting from Mexico. A friend of mine just posted, like, Mexican medical equipment. These things, like vehicles, $74.9 billion. Electronic equipment, $62.9 billion. Machinery, $49 billion. Oil, $14 billion. Medical technical equipment, $12 billion. So all these really high end, high value, high tech products. You know, produce is down at number, seven, and produce and fruits, and then tequila is not even on the list of top ten. So what I'm saying is he doesn't have a clue about the economy of Mexico-U.S. trade.
No.
Much of our beef and produce comes from South
America
and Mexico.
How do you install a dictatorial regime?
Right.
That's what we have. So it doesn't make sense from an economic standpoint or from a democratic standpoint or from even a business standpoint. It makes total sense from a dictatorial regime standpoint.
When we talk about the energy, do we see any new leaders coming out of this, any galvanizing people who could emerge as putting it all together?
We need a Bobby Kennedy or a Solon or an SDR or a Gracchi brother or something like that to pull us together.
Have we seen any of those?
I'm sorry, what's wrong with Bernie Sanders? Oh, never mind.
Actually, he is a very strong voice, and we need to, and we need to pump up that voice. Actually, I mean,
he's called himself a socialist. He has called himself a socialist. He is not a member of the Democratic Party. And
it doesn't matter.
Unfortunately, that word has been poisoned. That the word socialist has been poisoned.
It has been, but I think it's time to start unpoisoning it, frankly. And he stands for Democratic principles.
I am a socialist.
I stand for democratic principles, and I don't care what label you want to put on it. And we need to get that across.
But I think that we have.
He's a social democrat, and the millennials came out for him in droves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 30,000 people in Portland. That was the second time that he came. 10,000 in Eugene, 9,000 in Idaho Falls. Speaking of Idaho Falls, at 30,000 in Brooklyn, then 30,000 in the Bronx. You know, the same day or the next day. I mean, so a lot of people don't really care about this quote unquote socialist label.
The big problem is that this is unprecedented. This has never been done by a president before. And the president has broad discretion when barring what he deems undesirables.
Yeah.
And it's never been tested. So that's the unprecedented part is the big question.
Here's another thing that's fairly unprecedented in my opinion, and this is one of my other big concerns, huge concerns, and that is that when a federal court who enforces a federal court decision? In other words, you've got a bunch of judges there, and you've got federal courts, and they make a decision. And, you know, if a president just flagrantly, violates a federal court
they
decision.
They withhold funding. Federal government withholds funding. If you don't change your restaurants to non-smoking.
That's a congressional operation, and when the Congress is right wing, and they're going to back the president, this is essentially there's so many constitutional crises that are about to happen.
They may not be backing
one of them.
Linda, they may not be backing.
I think it's a key question, to see how many Republicans jump ship. Many of them are very uncomfortable with this.
What if the Democratic Party dies and the Republicans split?
Many of the early quotes, other than McCain, who didn't temper it, have said things like, well, I can see being concerned for national security, but this wasn't properly thought out or this wasn't properly done. They're all running for cover, but they're also trying to cover themselves with the party. So well, it could have been done better, or we blah, blah, blah.
The nominees are still being confirmed.
I think that if it keeps up, though, there'll be more and more heading for cover.
And there needs to be more and more of us out in the streets, quite frankly. And I think the only way for this to change, I think the momentum needs to be, I think the real power right now, emailing, petitions, phone calls, etc., letter writing campaign, that's all good. But the real power is when you have tens of thousands of people in the street, that's about the only way, on a continuing basis. This is what finally turned the corner. How many years did it take? This is what finally turned the corner on the Vietnam War, where there's, on a continual drumbeat basis, there were so many people out in the street.
I'm afraid that's
what it's going to take.
That's the point, by the way, that Indivisible has made, that you have to go to a congressperson's office, that it doesn't even work calling them up, that if all these people keep showing up at the congresspeople's office, that they get the message. Now, where I am, they're all Democratic congresspeople in the area. They still encourage you to go to those people to support them, but they definitely encourage there to be protests at the Republican congresspeople's office. If you don't shape up, you're gone. One of those deals. So,
but the problem is, this stuff's rolling out so quickly, they're not going to be gone in the next week. And if this keeps happening, like it happened just within the past week, if this kind of stuff keeps rolling out, quite frankly, a month from now, we might not have much of a country left.
I mean, just
well, it will keep
out,
rolling out. I mean,
the
doctrine and the what Robert Reich's colleague had said, the Republican colleague, is that basically they've got him in office. He's not really thinking of all this himself. There's a plan for him. How do you think all those documents to sign were already ready for his signature? He didn't put any effort into that whatsoever. They're going to use him. They're going to ride that what they believe is charisma for as long as they can, and then impeach him. That's pretty much what everybody believes.
He's being used by
the right.
Psychological anchoring is at play here, I think. This is what I kind of, the determination that I came to here is, he is so over the top bad and dangerous that then, you know, the more he comes down and the more, you know, and so we boot him out, right? And, you know, eventually he goes way too far enough that everybody says, okay, agree, he's got to go. So now we got Pence in there. And, you know, Pence is bad enough, an autocrat, et cetera. And so we've been psychologically anchored, and we're going to embrace, you know, the tendency is we're going to accept Pence because he's so much less bad than Trump.
Look how
but
polarized
not, that's
we
not,
are.
That's not the case. That's kind of like saying, I'm not going to die from, I refuse your cyanide, but okay, so I'll take the rat poison instead because it's not quite as bad as the cyanide.
If you point out these things to a Trump supporter, it only more firmly entrenches their support.
Two-dimensional world.
And for all the talk about impeachment, remember the wording. You can only impeach someone for high crimes and misdemeanors. So you have to determine. You can't impeach someone for craziness or for being the tool of the Russian government. You have to have some particular act to impeach
them. You can use the 25th Amendment to get rid of him as well. And that's another thing that's being discussed, you know, determining that all that there needs to be is a preponderance of his cabinet to determine that he cannot undertake the duties of the president. And
what's the
25th? Signed.
Who's going to do that?
It's a Woodrow Wilson FDR amendment that
you have
is incapacitated.
Republican Congress on both sides. Senate and House of Representatives are Republican. The Supreme Court will soon be Republican because the Democrats are voting in the Republican nominees anyway, and the White House is Republican. So I don't see that ever happening.
I understand that, but I don't see impeachment happening because it's Republican. But there is a way that the 25th Amendment could be invoked, and he's gone out. But look at it this way. He's already violated the emoluments provision.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, all of a sudden somebody could say, I'm shocked there's gambling going on. And, you know, and then call him on it, and that's it. And
now, are we talking emolument? Are we talking Moscow or business dealings abroad or income tax?
Yes.
What's that?
All of the above.
All of it. His hotel. The reason Indonesia, I know that what you said about the countries that were listed, but he is deeply embedded with the Indonesian government, and he has many projects that are undertaken, and he's got one in Bali, he's got one in the in Java and Sumatra, and they protect him, and he's getting money from that. So, you know, he may have transferred it to his children, and he may be telling us that he's not going to do any more. Be telling people that he's not doing any international business, but he is. I travel all the time, and I'm about to leave for Burma, Thailand, and Cambodia. And, Indonesia's, a place I go often as well. And I see Trump stuff everywhere. So it's going to be interesting.
In the last...
all they need to do is turn a spotlight on it. It's all there. Somebody has to decide they want to make use of it. And those could be Republicans. Who are just too embarrassed.
The scary thing in the last week, the Chinese the Chinese government, who have said that there is a possibility of war with the United States, because it was pointed out that he said that we're going to protect our interest in the South China Seas, and the Chinese government said, you have no interest in the South China Seas. Mikhail Gorbachev came out yesterday saying that for the first time in a long time, he sees a real possibility of war. And all this is very, very scary.
I wish there were a constitutional attorney on this call, because one of the things, there's a couple of things in my mind, but one of the things is that, the third branch of government does not like to get involved. It's like poison to them. They stay away from, political controversy as much as they possibly can. But they have a lot more latitude to act than they actually utilize. Very, very seldom does the Supreme Court unilaterally pick up and intervene, aside from their normal process of a case boiling up, through the federal court system to eventually to the Supreme Court. That's a normal avenue. But actually, the Supreme Court has at its disposal much more power than that. I'm not clear exactly the specifics about what power that they have, but I think there is a possibility that the Supreme Court, should they decide to act because the country is at risk, I think they can. And I wish there were a constitutional attorney to be able to provide that information. The other thing, here's another thing, and I've been saying this for a while, and that is that we are very, very close to being totally dependent on the professionalism of the law enforcement agencies and the DOD. So general officers, one of the things that happened in the Cuban Missile Crisis is there was a Russian submarine officer. It required three people to agree for the launch code to launch a nuclear weapon against the U.S. Turned out that it was, it was a false indicator that they had. But they were about to launch. There was one officer on that one submarine, Russian officer, who refused to add his name to the other two to make it a threesome to launch. We were that close to essentially destroying the world. We're all here today because of that one Russian officer who said, no, I'm not doing it. And we're very close to being, I think, totally dependent on the professionalism and the ethics of general officers within the military and decision makers within all of the law enforcement branches.
That also
law enforcement is militarized at this point anyway.
Yep.
We're talking about assembling and protesting. I'm sorry. But, I've seen unprovoked attacks by law enforcement on people who are just standing still.
Yeah.
They're just beating them senseless.
Mm-hmm.
There was another action during the Cuban Missile Crisis that it was our pilots. We had said that in our observation, if we were fired upon, that could cause a war. And there were two planes that were fired upon, and they went back to the attorney general who was running the task force, and they said, what do we say about these things? And they said, you were hit by birds. And they all said, yes, sir, we were hit by birds. And it never came out. And that only came out years later. Back to the political.
Go ahead and ask your question. But what I'm noticing is the conservative intellectuals condemning Trump. And I'm just looking at an article by Charles Krauthammer. And then there was an article in the Washington Post by George Will. So, I mean, he's getting flack from the real conservatives. How's that going to work out for him?
Yes, he is. They've been very nasty. And there's another one with the Washington Post, Michael Gerson, has been very strong about him.
Yeah, right.
And he was a speechwriter.
They're not birchers.
Now, I disagree about Bernie, who I was for to begin with. I think that his time has passed. Now, the name that I've heard as an attractive person who's liberal, who speaks well, but I don't know enough about him is Gavin Newsom. Does anyone have any comments on him? Anyone know more than I do about Gavin Newsom?
I've heard the name, but I'm unfamiliar.
Yeah, I know Gavin Newsom, you know, when he was, San Francisco mayor and, because I was working in San Francisco. And he is very attractive. You know, he's young. He's got an aura about him. But I also think Cory Booker, except for,
yes.
What his vote was related to bringing in medicines from Canada.
I don't think
Cory Booker
is reliable.
No. I like Jeff Merkley, one of my own senators. He's an awesome guy. He's the right age, the right progressive statements. So he's been an effective collaborator in the Senate, and I'd like to see him. I mean, he's also speaking out, so I'd like to see him come forward more as a candidate.
Al Franken is a beautiful guy. You know, I don't know what his chances are for any higher office, but the legislation that he brings forward and the amount of time that he spends on trying to stop these people, I just admire him so much. He is so active.
And we now know that there are so many different variables that enable you to run. Mark Zuckerberg, I was listening to a podcast today, and they were talking, do you think Mark Zuckerberg would actually run for president? You know, he's going on a 50 state visit. He will be 35 when it comes to filing. And, you don't need experience. So.
I'm sorry. No. Okay. No, Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, I'm with Eleanor on that one. I'm sorry, no.
I want somebody that knows politics, that has a background in law, that has governed before.
Yes.
I agree, totally, 100%. But
things are so crazy.
It's so crazy.
Ronald Reagan, that's crazy.
Glenn, what is Gavin Newsom now? He's no longer the mayor of San Francisco?
No, he's just under Jerry Brown. So, Jerry Brown's governor, and Gavin Newsom's just under him.
The lieutenant governor?
Lieutenant governor.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, he will become governor, Jerry Brown, next term. And Jerry Brown was my governor for two terms. And so that's possible. Kamala Harris is another one. She needs to get more experience, but she'll have the same experience that she's a lawyer. She has the same experience that Barack Obama would have at the same time in her career.
What about Elizabeth Warren? I'm a big fan of her. Does anyone have anything either negative or positive about her?
She sure is sharp, and she knows exactly who to go after.
Yep,
she's got
the
passion.
She sees
the great
bottom
thing about
line.
Her. Yeah, and she's already a powerful figure. I think we've got enough powerful progressives that we don't need to really look into the edges for up and coming people. And by the way, I don't really care about the youth of the presidential candidate. I would like to leave that out of the question. And young and good looking, yeah, there's a lot of people like that. Newsom may be a great candidate, but let's look at the people who've already put themselves out on the line and are fighting right now in the Congress for reform and progressive values.
As long as campaign funding remains the way it is. Then
as long as what funding?
As long as campaign funding rules remain, laws remain the way they are, then you are beholden to your provider. Therefore, if you don't do what they ask, then you won't even make it out of the primary. They'll find somebody who will do it. And we see that in Ohio. There's a guy named Josh Mandel who is just – and also Rob Portman. Rob Portman has been a corporate guy since day one. He represents the guy who finances him. He does not represent his constituency. and the whole nation is becoming like that. The constituency is the person who funds your campaign. And now you need big money to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Grassroots does not cut it.
I can remember when John McCain ran on the Straight Talk Express for campaign reform, campaign finance reform,
yeah.
I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just dead in the water now. But I agree.
We've been pulled so far to the right.
Is, the money in
American
politics.
American politics.
Really the Supreme Court decision for Citizens United is screwed democracy.
Right.
Just to try to get votes, Democrats are further to the right now than Republicans were 50, 60 years ago.
I don't think it's about the votes so much. I mean, look at the, let's go back to Bernie's base again. He had a massive, massive base. He did gather, he did get money, only he didn't take any corporate money whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And we can have another session to talk about the primaries, but he did extremely well. So it's possible to get around money in politics, but you need a very charismatic, energetic person of any age to carry that ball forward and not be opposed by the money, which is basically what happened to Bernie.
On retrospect, the Democrats were never going to allow a non-party member, a self-declared socialist, to be their candidate for president. They're too afraid of that.
Well, they also wanted to get their Hillary in, who to whom it was owed, but she was not an effective candidate.
Yeah. Boy, they hate her.
Yeah.
What is up with that? They just hate her with just something that's unreasonable.
Well,
yeah,
I agree with that.
That's
a problem. I have problems.
That's a fact, then we don't
campaign
with
Hillary,
with
but
it.
She would have been a good president.
Yeah,
even
she's
though
brilliant.
I have problems with her, we would not have been. We would not be on the edge of disaster like we are right now if Hillary were in office.
Yeah,
I would rather have had somebody else other than Hillary, but we would not be in a disaster mode like we are today with, if she were in office.
She would have been.
No, you don't want to hear it, but Truman was as clumsy as Trump. You know, Truman went around throwing our weight around and threatening people and saying ridiculous things, and he had us closer to war with Russia than just about anybody. Eisenhower, certainly.
Hillary would have been a competent president. She wouldn't have been a reform president the way the way either Bernie or Warren.
They would have opposed her the same as they opposed
President
Obama.
Well, and the thing is, all those anti-establishment votes which could have gone to Bernie went to Trump. People who just didn't really know what they wanted, but they didn't want establishment, which she he represented.
He's a deconstructionist. Trump is. That whole thing. That's what Bannon's all about.
Glenn,
he's a tyrant. He's a plutocrat. He's a tyrant. He really is a tyrant. He is a monarch. He wants to be a monarch. I mean, he's putting all his family in charge in his inner circle. When you read, I should send you a list of all of the books on Russia that I've read recently, because everybody needs to read them. I mean, there's a reason that he's sucking up to Putin. Basically, Putin is his role model. And when you read what Putin has done in Russia, you know, this guy is doing basically the same thing. He's a tyrant. Putin is a tyrant. This guy is a tyrant. Putin destroyed democracy in Russia. You know, the burgeoning democracy is, you know, took a far right turn. And this guy's doing the very same thing. He's taken that as, you know, as his role model and as
left
his playbook.
Left open to venture capitalism.
Linda,
unregulated capitalism.
Linda,
that's how
inner circle. Now, actually, it's not capitalism per se. It's inner circle. It's only his inner circle. Because you know that one of the biggest oil executives, or, you know, oil industry owners, right, in Russia, got at odds with Putin. And
they got murdered.
Putin.
Putin put him into jail.
Yeah, but he stripped assets.
About,
I mean, they basically stole his oil company from him, and they were trying to jail him, and he finally left. I think he's in London right now. But
Putin
basically destroyed him.
The one who went to London got murdered in London.
That went to London.
Yeah,
and one of them got one or more. Actually, there was something that came across yesterday, today. There was somebody else was murdered, and they're thinking, you know, some other Russian guy who was calling out Putin, and he was murdered.
I saw that.
Yeah.
Thank heavens the United States never does anything like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right.
So let me interrupt for a minute and just move to perhaps down the topic. Glenn, you tried to put together this list of how we might proceed, an action item, and there are other lists that you've joined and you've put us into of the ways to resist, ways to proceed. Have you come up with an action plan for yourself that you can share with us?
I wish I could say yes. Tomorrow we're having a cyber cafe meeting. I think it's 8:30 East Coast time. You know, in the hope, okay, now what do we do? Really, it's so hard when you're a distributed group for people to come up with a single action point. And my original belief in creating the group was that small acts, when multiplied by a lot of people, become one big act. And I just, you know, I have found many lists of what people should do, you know, like calling your congressman, but I don't know that calling your congressman works. If I could call the congressman from Ohio, you know, that might work, but they don't care that I've called. I like what's been happening now, at least on weekends. I don't think people will fill the airports on the weekdays because people have to work. But I just, you know, I wish I had an answer to that. And in closing, I wanted to say that on a just a tangential issue related back to refugee and immigration, and I work in an NGO which is associated with Johns Hopkins University, and I'm in a group of people who work at NGOs, and basically a lot of our workforce that goes back and forth to like Afghanistan and Iraq, Africa, are green card people or H-1B people. And so we're really telling people in that position to come back to the U.S. regardless, you know, to come back, work from the U.S., do not run the risk of whether, like I just had I have a South Sudanese person. Now, I don't trust the people in the airport know the difference between South Sudan and Sudan. You know, and so they might say, you know, you can't come in. So I'm asking him to come back, you know, to the U.S. And I
might
see
be too
other
late.
People. Yeah, well, the hope is that won't happen. But also trips. We all have trips scheduled. We do a monthly cycle of trips, you know, all across the world. And it's like inhibiting our business, and we deal a lot with state. And when those four people walked out of state and they left before they were fired, that was a big, you know, warning for us, you know, what might happen. You know, Rex Tillerson comes in, they determine that certain countries are valuable and certain countries aren't valuable. You know, the African nation, the African continent isn't valuable by and large, given a Rex Tillerson view. So maybe they stop funding for HIV or for, you know, saving lives of women at birth. You know, so
well, China will be there to fill the gap. So
no,
he is
well,
already virtually cut off Planned Parenthood funding overseas.
No, I know. The gag order is one thing, and I see the Chinese all the time when I'm in Africa, but the Chinese aren't there to save lives. They don't build hospitals.
No.
That's not their intervention. They build 6,800 miles of roads for Congo, and in Malawi, they get oil rights for Lake Malawi. So, and they'll export it. They'll create, you know, all they care about is feeding their ecosystem. And they're not worried about the lives. So, but John, I just wanted to say thank you for including me on this call. I need to move on. I need to go. So
maybe they won't let you back in the country, Glenn, when you live.
Yeah, so. Maybe that'll be the case. All right. Thank you, everyone. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Glenn.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
I did want to add something about what's next, but maybe I'll take my turn. But we have some things going on here that might be useful.
Okay, go.
Oh, okay. I met a bunch of local progressives and independents during the primary who all basically are doing a grassroots mobilization to get progressives into the Democratic Party here in Oregon, and they've now been successful. They've become precinct committee members in their precincts. Then they get, they can move up to offices in the Democratic Party of Oregon. So I'm basically, to me, that is the most. I mean, aside from broadcasting my opinions all over Facebook and putting information in front of people, I think the local grassroots politics, conventional politics, is going to be a big path forward. Because our parties, our Democratic parties, if you take a close look at them, there's a lot of incumbents, there's a lot of niche fillers, there's a lot of defensive action, and there's not a lot of innovation in a lot of the states. So this is where I'm going to be focusing my efforts, just in my precinct.
Well, Republicans did that very well. They focused on the state houses who determined then at the census they were in charge of the redrawing of the lines, and then they had Congress people, their
state legislatures, local elections.
They're
what do you
people
think?
And they think strategically, and strategic thinking is almost anathema to progressive way of thinking, unfortunately, and it's.
I don't think so. I'm saying exactly the opposite.
Really,
there's a very energized group here in Oregon who are thinking strategically and who have already gotten themselves into positions in the state Democratic Party, and that's what I think should be a model for everybody.
What do you think, Ron?
Well, I think that FDR is right, that we need to have a coalition of minorities in a liberal party.
Mm-hmm.
And Linda spoke of that earlier. All of the different other and less than and people who don't. I mean, for instance, we were talking about the refugees. That's the header of our program. Why does the country not have a refugee fund? Why do we not have something to draw from to help? Our treatment of Mexico is shameful.
Mm-hmm.
Historically, it will be looked upon as shameful. We behave worse than the Romans, no doubt about it. More than 7 million children in the United States live with parents from Mexico. Half of these children are estimated to be U.S. citizens living with non-citizen parents.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we treat our neighbors,
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, I'm so ashamed of that. It's ridiculous.
The good
I thought
friend
we
of
were
mine,
something else.
The good friend of mine here in Yorktown has spent 25 years in Guatemala. And he's going back, and he talks about all of the young children who are sent by their parents to escape the gangs and all criminal activities there.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to lock them up and to send them back where they'll be killed, and it's just awful.
Mm-hmm.
My attitude is bring them, please bring them.
Yeah.
We'd love to have them. For some reason, I'm, a voice of the wilderness, I guess. Bring them on.
Well, not amongst this group, anyway.
Thank you. I thought the whole idea was that we were supposed to be inclusive, but it's our capitalism not being regulated is inevitably tilting toward control by the rich. Every other country has health care. If you don't have health care, if the health care industry can prevent us from having health care, the insurance industry, the pharmaceutical industry, then they're more powerful than the government. And that's,
they are.
We slipped into something that is no longer a democratic republic.
In today's climate, there would be no Medicare. Now, there may soon not be any anyhow, mm-hmm. but it never would have gotten through Congress. So,
And, actually, the gal who was on earlier from Romania said something that was, in my mind, really, really key, which is that the population there, the leaders there, that, you know, her family was the, you know, the people
yeah.
there and her family, including her family, were subjected to, was the attitude that the population, you know, the populace is viewed as basically machinery of, you know, they're the worker bees, they're the ones
mm-hmm.
that create wealth, that then that wealth, you know, bubbles up to
she
the
said communist
class.
Romania, and I wonder what she means by communist Romania.
Well, Romania under communism
regime as well.
Well,
it,
you know,
it was,
I mean, the United States
regime.
Definition of communism is highly inaccurate.
Well, no,
right.
it was a satellite. It was a Soviet country. It was part of the Soviet Union, so it was
when
definitely
she, okay.
officially
when
communist
she,
when she was there.
Right.
Yes.
When she
now.
Came here, right?
Yeah.
Right. That was the that was behind
the
old Iron Curtain.
So it's a dictatorial regime.
The authoritarian mindset is that the populace is only there in order to create wealth. To bubble up
yeah.
to the ruling class,
yeah.
to the,
five
the small circle ruling elite.
But
and,
that's the same, Linda, in a purely capitalist country that workers are replaceable parts, and
yes.
you know, and you're always told that you can be replaced, and
yeah.
and they're right, and if you
yeah.
if you think about this, any jobs. That you've ever had to be very important to you, and it's and they promote this.
Mm-hmm.
When I was putting in systems and brokerage firms, boy, that was very important because I changed this and to change that, and then to step away, and in 100 years, no one's ever going to have heard of you.
Right.
Martin Luther King that would have been heard about, or John Kennedy, or unfortunately probably
right.
Donald Trump. But we are all only cogs in the machine of hopefully progress.
But
and,
it's a matter. But John, it's a matter of extent. When you're in a democracy or a quasi democracy, people are valued much more than when you're in a pure authoritarian regime.
Individually,
and, you know, we're on the verge of being an authoritarian regime, and the part of the reason why there is, you know, they're pulling the safety rug out from under is quite, you know, people who are broken, people who are sick, people who are old. Basically, people who are not sufficiently functional in this machine that creates wealth that will trickle up are expendable. And it doesn't matter if they die. Soldiers, it doesn't matter if they die. Actually, it was a book that I read recently that basically said one of the clearest markers of the difference between a democracy and an autocracy is the attitude towards soldiers. So in an autocracy, soldiers are totally expendable. You know, so after you use them, you know, they can die. It doesn't matter. You got your use out of them. It really doesn't matter. You're not going to spend, you know, you're not going to spend treasure to go in and to equip soldiers sufficiently or to retrieve them out of dangerous situations. You just let them die. In a democracy, those soldiers are recognized as being family members, their children, their sons, their, you know, whatever. And you're willing to pay the money in order to give them the equipment that they need. And when they're in trouble, you retrieve them. And when they're injured,
there for the
you
right
take care
reasons.
Of them.
They're there for the right reasons, you know.
In the
that
Korean
the people
War.
Who are, yeah, I mean, the people who are, the American empire is about protecting American interests abroad when we're talking about foreign military engagements. Almost exclusively,
mm-hmm.
that's what we end up in. So even though those guys believe they're there for the right reasons, you know, they're indoctrinated, and we've got Academy or whatever they're called now, Blackwater Academy. You know, it's just but they're making it impossible for us to vote for a liberal candidate to unseat them. You know,
the way they
redraw voting districts and things like this, making people ineligible.
They're installing the mindset of a top, literally a top-down hierarchy, where it's only the only ones that are important are the small circle of elite on the top, and everybody else is expendable. I mean, that really is a fundamental mindset. And so all of the things that, you know, this is why the rug is being pulled out from social safety nets. This is why the attack on Social Security and the attack on Medicare and Medicaid. This is, you know, VA benefits are going to be under attack. Education, you know, they're going to pull the rug out from under education because you don't need
they
to
want,
educate people.
They want public education completely dismantled.
In the Korean
War, question about it.
Take it back to what Linda was saying. In the Korean War, when the Chinese human wave that came down to fight the Americans, the people in the third or the fourth rank of the human wave didn't have weapons. They were expected to pick up the weapons from the guys who got killed in front of them, then to go on.
Yes.
We have a caller now from the 219 area code. Who's that? 219 area code?
Yes, it's Robert Austin.
Oh, hello. We're almost winding down. What do you have to tell us? To what's your observation on what's going on with immigration and what's going on locally, politically with you?
That's okay. I just called in to listen. I'm a friend of Linda's.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, I'm glad that Linda has friends. I think that's terrific.
I have one.
You've got two. You've got me. any last comments from anyone? Anything that you wanted to say that you haven't been able to? We'll start with Eleanor.
With me? Last comments. I don't see this. I see that there's a very, very bad and threatening tendency. I think we're at a moment of severe crisis. But I just don't see this putsch being able to hang on. So it's going to be very interesting what happens in the next 6 months. I believe we will see some kind of change for sure. We cannot go on the way we've gone on the last week. And I'm hopeful that there will actually be an opportunity for something positive out of it.
Duran?
The thing that comes to my mind foremost is that we are deporting parents. We have been doing it since the Obama administration. We've ramped it up now. The children are, I can't even find a number on how many children we have now in foster care or with single parents who can no longer make a living. And you know what? That's the same thing we did in the antebellum South.
Yeah.
We separated married couples. We tore children from their mothers. You know, when are we going to catch on? I keep wondering. You know, all empires fall.
Yeah.
Delinda?
Yeah, all empires fall. Unfortunately, some of those empires take a hell of a long time to fall. One of the things that is just has been screaming at me for so long, and that is in order, you know, one of the key factors in getting people to better pay attention to actually start reasoning, quite frankly, is the religious community. And for example, I have colleagues who are very well educated, but I have several actually colleagues who are members of the religious right. And they're conservative. And one of them in particular was an adamant Trump voter. He's a fundamentalist, right? There are a lot of people, I mean, we tend to blow them off as being, you know, unreasonable or not educated or whatever. No, they are, as far as I'm concerned, they are members that have been sucked into a cult, and unfortunately it's a very big cult. And one of the obstacles that we have is this the religious right community that is keeping this cultish attitude that wants to target people. And we need to pull, the only way to, you know, outsiders can't pull the rug out from under that, can't expose that. It takes insiders to do that. So one of the the groups that needs to be violently embraced are the progressive religious leaders, mostly the Christian progressive leaders. Also, the Jewish would be very, very useful because Jews are actually pretty powerful. But
I didn't know there was such a thing as a progressive religious leader.
Progressive Jews.
I thought they kicked them
but,
out.
There are, of course, there are. All the mainstream churches are progressive.
Yeah, yeah. But the mainstream churches, though, have taken, they've been losing parishioners for decades. And so the ones that are really healthy and growing and all of that is the religious right. So it's the mega church leaders, it's the TV church leaders. And this
Bible
is, yeah. And these are the people who are cult leaders. And it's only the progressive religious people, religious leaders who are equipped, who have the authority to pull the rug. I mean, I'm not Catholic and I have no intention of being Catholic, right? But thank God for this Pope, because this Pope is speaking out. But he's one voice.
Mm-hmm.
We need the Quakers. We need the UCC. We need the Presbyterians. We need the Methodists. We need the American Baptists. We need
Episcopalians.
Yada, 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 yada. Those people need to be front and center and embraced,
mm-hmm.
because those are the ones that have the authority to call out this totalitarianism that has taken over.
They were very big in the anti-war movement, if you will recall. Maybe you don't.
Yes.
Yep.
Methodists and Presbyterians have liberal hierarchies. The people who are in charge of these churches, the way ups, they are liberal. They have a liberal stance. But their memberships are conservative.
Two comments.
I don't necessarily agree with that.
On religious groups. On the Catholic side, some of the most progressive people are the nuns, obviously. The nuns on the bus and just Simone Campbell. On religious right, he's been able to do something. He's been able to sell himself, even though he's not only a three married guy, he's a public adulterer. He's a person who has behaved unethically.
Mm-hmm.
By ripping off contractors and employees and investors.
Because we have a different moral standard.
Yet he's been able to get
away with it. This is about Mike Pence. So this is what Mike Pence is doing as vice president.
Yes.
He is drawing all the evangelical voters who have only one reason to vote, and that is to get a Supreme Court justice that will overturn Roe v. Wade, and they are not looking at anything else.
That is correct.
Yes. Yes. And that's that whole strict father. I can't remember now who came up with that.
Lakoff.
Is it Lakoff?
George Lakoff.
Yeah. Okay. The strict father. So the strict father mentality appeals. It's an authoritarian mentality, and it appeals to the religious right. And the religious left needs to pull the rug out from under that. And it's only the religious left that can. Is equipped to pull the rug out from under and say,
well,
the religious right
thinks that all other Christians are heathens and going to hell, okay?
So they need to be marginalized. They need to be marginalized. They need to be called out, not just by the Pope, but by the Pope and all the rest of these guys standing arm in arm saying, these attitudes are anti-Christ.
But Linda,
clearly.
But Linda, there are no Dan Berrigans or William Sloan Coffin around that we know of now. and we have to find them if there are any.
We have Dobsons and Falwells and Franklin Grahams.
Right.
Bill Rothsteins.
Interesting question. Who are the leaders in the mainstream liberal progressive churches?
There are some, actually. And several years ago, I made a concerted effort to try to connect with several of them. Actually, I invited a few to this broadcast because they need to be embraced. So the ones that are the head of the Christian left on Facebook, for example, is one, Mark Sandlin, and then there's Chuck Curry out in, Oregon or Washington, academic there at a religious institution, and
most Protestant churches are Pauline. They are based in the writings of Paul in the New Testament. And even though he was kind of liberal for his time, he's telling women to go to the back, sit down, shut up. And we have a big population, big percentage of the population in the United States that is Protestant and white. And I think that's part of the problem they had with Mrs. Clinton, at least part of it.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And the only way to pull the rug out from under that, it has to be Christian voices who have the authority to say this is unchristian. This is the opposite of Christ's teaching. These are the people that have the authority in order to do that.
But we have to find them. We have to promote them then, Linda. That becomes our problem, too.
Exactly. Yes.
Well, can I ask a question? I'm sorry. I don't know what the schedule is for this because I'm going to have to leave.
I'm about to wrap it up and to thank you all. So, and having
right.
said that,
thank you.
Thank you all. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for letting me voice my opinion.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
A bit of commercial information, as I mentioned, my last column in which is a Guardian by now the collector's piece, is available online along with columns by ex-Congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission Lee Hamilton and critic John Simon at www.whichisaguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon and I blog at medium.com. Send any comments about this show or anything else to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in the book. I hope you'll join me next week. And good night, everybody.
Good night.
Pray for John.
Yay, bye.